888-5484. WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
WPFW, Washington, 89.3 FM.
Hey, it's Chris Garlock. For the next hour, we're bringing you another show I produce. It's called the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, and it features excerpts from shows in the Labor Radio Podcast Network. I really hope you enjoy it.
Hey, guys.
Yes.
Before we start, I'm getting Labor Day weekend started off.
Way ahead of you, right bro. Away. Way ahead of you. This is number two.
What is that, nice red wine?
No. This is a local upstate New York brew, which I don't remember the name of. But I have to tell you, I was at the open house for the brand spanking new Rochester Labor Library just about 2 hours ago.
I
was just there seeing some old friends, meeting some new friends, checking out the cool library. And there was the head of the Teamsters was over showing off this can of specially brewed Genesee beer that they did together with all of the unions at the brewery. So, of course, you guys know me. I whipped out my phone and I recorded, and we'll have it on the Labor Heritage Power Hour probably next week. He told the whole story behind how this came to be and all the unions that are involved in making this brew. It was great. And he said, oh, did you want to take a tour of the brewery? So next time I come up, I'm going to get a tour of the brewery. So it was a good day.
That's fantastic. And brewing is an art, and there is culture involved. So win-win.
Speaking culture of the labor movement.
I always feel very cultured after having a brew. So what can I tell you?
Well, the fact that we're recording this at 9 p.m. Eastern when you guys should be in bed.
And it says
how much we worked to make this happen, because you have to turn around and get on the road tomorrow morning.
Both of us do. Yeah, we're heading to Wheeling, West Virginia for the Walls Symposium. Is that what it's called, Patrick?
It's the Pollock Symposium, sponsored by the Walls Foundation, I think.
There it is. Ruther Pollock. Look for those coming up in both Labor History Today and the Labor Heritage Power Hour soon. But first, this is the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, in case you were wondering. Maybe you tuned into something else, but no. And we are, of course, the show that samples the very, very best of the Labor Radio Podcast Network.
Where working people speak.
That's right. You can find out more at laborradionetwork.org. You can check out Labor Radio Pod because of Harold's fantabulous work. And Harold has a new, it's not a flip phone, it's a side flip. What do you call that thing, Harold?
It's a new age flip phone. It's what they call a foldable phone, and it is defeating me. I'm still trying to figure out how to work it.
All right. And of course,
you're able to do the flippy part though.
Oh, I can flip. I mean, I'm good at flipping. Hey, Chris, right. You might want to find out more at laborradionetwork.org and hashtag Labor Radio Pod.
Find out more at laborradionetwork.org or check out hashtag Labor Radio Pod on the socials. Thank you, Harold. I, of course, am Chris Garlock here with Harold Phillips and Patrick Dixon, fresh off the soccer fields. And on today's show, we have got clips from
Project Labor.
Lifeguarding is probably 85% prevention. Mm. So, we don't want to make the rescue. We want to keep you safe so that that doesn't happen.
The Alberta Worker Podcast.
Like, I came to the realization, never in my life had I thought I was a lefty. And I was like, this is why workers unionize.
Concrete Gang.
I believe some of the cops were working through people's houses going, oh, how did you afford this?
Solidarity Works.
It's its own little city, would you say, within the underground. Because pretty much what we have on surface, as far as mechanical and the electricians, and it's down there as well.
Blue Collar News.
Working people are finally fed up. They're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and they want to make change, and they're realizing, why not me? Why not now? And I think that it's amazing that union members want to step into that space.
and the Labor Exchange.
And he and some other Wobblies managed to both organize and kind of take hold of this strike here in Colorado.
And I have to say a very special welcome to listeners on WPFW. That's the Pacifica station in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., which will be picking up this edition of The Weekly for a special 2026 Labor Day programming.
That's right. You may be listening to this on the podcast channel, but if you're listening to it before Monday, September 7th, 2026, tune in to WPFW. You might hear us over the air.
Jazz and justice.
Jazz and justice, indeed. All right, folks, here is the show. Project Labor. Patrick, what can you tell us about Project Labor?
Joe Bongiovanni is the ultimate lifeguard. He's done hundreds and hundreds of rescues over the course of his career. He's now in charge of the Asbury Park Beach. In this episode, Danny and Joe talk about what kinds of people work as lifeguards, what they think of the work, and what are some of the tough and fast decisions they have to make. What do they do when there's 20 people in the water that need rescuing? And what do they do in the off-season?
Cool people, cool jobs. At Project Labor, we've got both. Welcome to the show. Project Labor is the podcast that celebrates the daily grind by diving deep into the lives and careers of people doing interesting work. Each episode asks the essential questions. What do you actually do all day? How do you feel about your work? And how'd you get here? Tune in for the honest stories behind the paycheck. Welcome to Project Labor. Lifeguard Joe Bongiovanni is in charge of the most interesting beach on the East Coast, Asbury Park, New Jersey, a place he's protected for 59 years. A permanent light sunburn coats his skin. His hands are dry, but his fingertips are pruned. He wears a yellow and red tank top and a matching hat that reads Asbury Park Lifeguard. His mustache is almost long enough to blow in the wind. Joe is what Hulk Hogan wished he looked like. I found him on the beach. Hop in, he said. And I got in his green Yamaha side-by-side to do the interview. I'd assumed we'd go to his trailer office, but like a true waterman, he chose the beach.
Why did you become a lifeguard?
Well, I grew up on the Jersey Shore. I grew up right across the street from Shark River down the road, and I grew up on the beaches in Avon further down. And I just always thought that would be a great way to make money in the summertime. So when I got to be the age of to lifeguard, I took the test and I started lifeguarding.
Do you think that lifeguards get enough credit for what they do?
No, not at all, not at all. When you think about the number of people, like just pick New Jersey, that go to the beach on a daily basis, you know, millions of people go, and they're on the beach being protected by, in many cases, 16, 17, 18-year-old kids. Mm. Now, again, they're usually supervised by older adults, but that's what's there. They're trained, how many drownings do you have on beaches during bathing hours when there are lifeguards on duty during the summer? Mm. And then how many do you have after hours or on guarded beaches?
Yeah.
So pretty much, you know, 99 point whatever percent are after hours or on unguarded beaches when the lifeguards are not around. So that's just, like I said, if you want to do the math on that, you know, how much they actually do and how many lives they're actually saving just through prevention, not only through rescues, but just through preventions. And, you know, we keep a lot of statistics here, and one of them is, you know, is personal contacts. How many times we, you know, whistle at somebody and call them over, or call them in, or move over, and then go over and talk to them and tell them why they had to move over, explain to them that there's a rip there, explain to them why it was dangerous for them to be where they were, and that kind of thing. And we have tens of thousands of those in the course of a summertime.
Yeah.
So all that, again, our philosophy here is lifeguarding is probably 85% prevention. So, you know, we don't want to make the rescue. We want to keep you safe so that that doesn't happen. But ocean conditions being what they are on some days, no matter what you do, we're going to have rescues.
Yeah.
Last weekend, we had very bad conditions on the ocean. And we had dozens of rescues here.
Wow.
Even though we kept the people in close, and we kept a watch on them. Again, they were moving people around, herding them away from the rips and into safer areas. But like I said, it still happens. So, you know, we have to be ready for that. You know, a lot of good swimmers come here, and there's, you know, different rescue techniques that we teach. But I think the hardest thing is to get them to watch the water consistently, know where the rips are, know where the bad situations are, and, like I said, prevent the tragedy before it even gets started
right
here. So that's a big part of lifeguarding, in my estimation.
What are some of the tools that you use? I know we're in this quad type vehicle.
Okay, well that gets us around, and if you notice, we have several of them. So
yeah.
And so we have a system that when, and we only have 3 or 4 lifeguards on benches at different times, and people are on break, so there's different numbers during the course of the day. So if something happens, by radio we contact the next bench, you know, to let them know we're going in the water, stand by. Okay, it's worse than we expected. Send somebody for help. So with the quad, somebody can get, you know, from one beach to the next in a matter of seconds. So now we have backup, because if we have 3 lifeguards on a bench and someone is in trouble, the first one goes out with a rescue torp.
This is that yellow or red oval shaped flotation device you've probably seen before. It has some grips on it for the lifeguard and for the people they're rescuing.
You can have a rescue torpedo. They get out there and they can secure the victim and they can float on them. And if they're caught in a rip, it's very difficult. You're not going to cross chest that person in or swim the person in. So the second person will go out with a rescue line. And then we have to have another person on the beach to pull all of those people in. So that's 3 people rescuing, yeah, you know, one person. So now who's on the bench watching the water or clearing the water, something happens. So when that happens, we have a call and we say, you know, send help. So in certain states, they'll say 1, send 2. And the neighboring beaches will send 1 person. So that now we have backup and we have somebody there who's emptying the water out so that nobody else gets in trouble, and watching the people that are in the water coming in. So there's always eyes on the water and the people are protected.
I'm your host, Danny Larkins. I'm excited to build a living catalog of the modern American workplace with you. Thank you for listening to Project Labor, and see you next time.
Hello, this is Eric Lee from Labor Start. We're proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
The Alberta Worker Podcast is, of course, from Alberta, Canada, and really interesting piece. Kim Seaver talks to Jimena Gonzalez, and she's a Calgary-based freelance journalist who has a really, really fascinating background. As usual, this is one of these episodes that we had to leave so much on the cutting room floor. You are going to get just a tiny taste. You're going to have to go and listen to the original show, folks.
And I believe that this is the final episode of Kim's 2026 season. He's a labor journalist who writes multiple labor stories up there in Alberta, but every summer he sits down and talks to workers in Alberta about their stories. And he's done a bunch over the course of this summer, so I'm really glad we were able to get one into the weekly.
Hey, fellow workers, I am Kim Seaver, and you are tuning in to episode 8 of season 5 of the Alberta Worker Podcast. We are a proud member of the Labor Radio Network, as well as a member of the Harbinger Media Network. for broadcasting from the homeland of the Niitsitapi. And today I am pleased to introduce our guest, Ximena Gonzalez. Welcome, Ximena.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. I'm happy you're here to join us for our season finale.
My name is Ximena Gonzalez, and I am originally from Mexico. I grew up going to like Catholic private school, so it was like a very narrow view of the world that I had until I went to university. And that's where I was exposed to, I would say, the failures of capitalism and how things don't work the same way for everyone, even though everybody works as hard, if not harder. So I kind of started to have questions. In Mexico, it's a little bit different. Like, basically, you have to make important life choices when you are 17. Because that's it. Like, you go to university, and it's not like here that you have a minor and a major, and then you kind of, like, wing it depending on what you like. In Mexico, you choose, and that's it. That's a life sentence.
Okay.
So I sentenced myself to architecture because it seemed, well, creative. We were pulling an all-nighter. The main architect arrived something like at 3 a.m. and wanted to make some changes.
What?
Yes. And I was like, that's not happening. Because you change one thing and you have to change all the drawings.
Right.
We were not working with new, like, modern software where everything changes. If you change, say, I don't want the sink in this corner, I want it in this other corner, you have to change all the drawings. A tiny change is a big deal. So him arriving at 3 a.m. and asking for a change was like, I was just like, no. And then asking, hey, so can I arrive later tomorrow? No, you're expected to work, come here at 8. And I was like, this is why people unionize.
Yeah, no doubt.
Like, I came to the realization, never in my life had I thought I was a lefty. And I was like, this is why workers unionize. Plus also, our hours are being counted and the client is being billed for these hours. The company is getting paid for our extra work. Yet as workers, as employees, we did not see that benefit. We were not banking hours. Nothing, not even pizza in that place, because sometimes it's like, yay, here is pizza to entice you, but no, nothing. That was awful. So I was like, no, this is not what I want for my life. So I quit. I didn't wait to be fired.
I'll show you guys.
And that is also where I learned that it's expensive to be poor. You know, because the less money somebody had, the higher the interest rates. And the accrued interest they end up paying.
The longer the terms.
Exactly, exactly. So they would end up paying 2 or 3 times the initial cost of the car just because they didn't have the money out front,
right.
Which I thought was like, whoa, like it's f***ed up. My labor history has been more, before coming to Canada, was more about privilege than about actually being working class. Individual who had to make ends meet with their labor. I couldn't get any work outside of like retail after I did my master's. Yeah, it was like this Mexican person can't know things. So I started doing like communications for architecture firms. That's where I wrote my first byline under somebody else's name, but it was good. At some point while I was here in Calgary, I started following Jeremy classes.
Mm-hmm.
When he started the sprawl and he was looking for someone to manage his social media, I was like, I can do that. So working there, he kind of realized how opinionated I am in real life. And he was like, oh, you should write about that. He said something like immigrants choose to be hard workers, which to me was like, we don't choose to be hard workers. We have to be hard workers. The bare minimum that's expected from us is to work hard. So I wrote my first real byline and I actually ventured to talk to interview strangers and it was very fulfilling. And obviously readers liked it. It's so simple. You know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. There are no bootstraps. I left mine in Mexico. They still work there, but they don't work here.
And even so, like, that doesn't even make any sense because bootstraps are for pulling your boots on. So if you can't literally physically pull yourself up from your bootstraps, it's literally impossible. That's right.
Yes. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Kimena, for joining us today. And thank you to all the listeners for joining in. And as always, solidarity.
Hey, this is Joshua Town from the Solidarity Report podcast. I'm proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts across the country and around the globe. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where the working people speak. You can find us at laborradionetwork.org.
Next up is the Concrete Gang, another one from one of our other parts of the world. Patrick?
Well, the Concrete Gang, they've had a hell of a week. There were police raids on officers of the CFMEU, Construction in General. That's the union that the guys are represented by. They're going to talk all about it.
I like the title of this episode, Coppers at the Door.
Coppers at the Door for a bit of nothing.
For people who don't know the Australian labor movement, there's been a lot of controversy about the CFMEU. That's the construction workers union out there. They were actually put into what I believe they call receivership or maybe administration because of allegations that the union had been taken over by organized crime. So I'm guessing that this police raid probably has something to do with that. And the scallywags and sooks on the show are probably going to have something to say about it.
Before we move on, one quick question. Patrick, did Sweet Lips Murphy not make the cut?
We did not include the chat about cranes. You know Sweet Lips Murphy is going to be a guy. Because you know what those guys are like.
I just can't believe you cut Sweet Lips.
Everyone has a funny nickname in there.
It's a fact. You got your gorilla, you got your campo, you got your Sweet Lips.
It's good morning from the Concrete Gang, 3CR Community Radio, 8:55 on your AM dial every Sunday morning. What time were you? 9:30?
9:30.
Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
9:30.
We've got three trees here.
How are we? It's freed trees.
Freed
trees.
And the Southeast Shadow.
Morning. How are we, lads?
Good to be here.
Up on a boat, aren't we?
Talk about a big week. Right. Jeez.
That's a bit happening, huh?
Bit of an understatement, isn't it? You know? But we're out the other side and still doing the business.
That's it, mate.
We've been pissed on by better people than that.
That's right. I suppose while we're talking, we may as well just get straight into it.
That's it.
Yeah, why even hold back?
Yeah. Obviously, we had five officials. Arrested. What do you want to call it? Arrested.
Yeah. Arrested. Cautioned. Whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
I'd call it a media witch hunt, personally.
I'd call that too. Overuse of police power.
Yeah. Yeah,
something that's not worth your time.
12, 13 cops rolling up to each of five of the officials.
Homes.
Raiding their homes. Going through their drawers and everything.
Taking photos.
Arresting them, handcuffing them, towing their cars.
Filming it all.
And they were there for majority of them were just for the electrical devices, weren't they?
Yep.
Phones, hard drives, all that stuff, which we could have just handed them in, but no, they had to do the media tow the cars.
Was the media there?
No, the media weren't there, no.
No.
Sort of makes you beg the question, if they're filming everything and there's no media there,
so they get
how does the media get a hold of it?
Yeah, that's right.
So is your private personal information being handed over from the police to the to the media?
Yeah, that's right. So they're doing the work for the media
so
now.
So who's policing the police? They're meant to be impartial.
That'd be our friendly Labor government, I'd say.
Yeah. Obviously someone wants to make a point coming up to the election.
Yeah, that's right.
Look, let's be honest, there's better ways of going around getting what they wanted, you know what I mean? Like you said at the start, like if they went to the office and asked for it, they would have got it all, but nah, they felt the need to drag people's families through the mud.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Which the other side of it is they say our officers got raided. I think only three or four police rolled up and just grabbed some cyber stuff out of there, whereas when it went to the officials' homes, there was between 9 and 12 cops at each person's house.
Yeah. That's right.
You know?
Huge waste of resources. What about the affected families too?
Yeah, not to mention, like, we've got firebombings everywhere, shootings every day, but the CFMU are the baddest thing, worst thing happening to the state at the minute.
A construction site, which is, you know, I mean, end of the day, if anything's happening on site, it's a workplace-related matter for the workplace regulator.
That's right, exactly right.
You know what I mean? If anything else is going on, if the boss are doing crooked deals behind the thing, it's something to do with the workers, and it's nothing to do with the union.
No, you know what I mean? Why aren't they arresting them in front of their
families? The reality of it is they can trace bank accounts and all from the bosses, who they're 100%. Paying, who they're invoicing, all this sort of stuff. None of it has a CFMEU on it. So
that's right.
Like we said, it's nothing different to being an official. It's sort of sometimes expected, but it's the families that cop.
Yeah, you know exactly what I mean? Right.
It's, you know what I mean? Right. If your missus is a teacher, nurse, whatever, she didn't sign up.
No one signed up for that.
People trashing their homes over stuff that's not fabricated lies and all this stuff. So
doesn't make it easy, but they're not designed to make it easy for us. That's why we're here.
And look, at the end of the day, it's all about trying to cut the workers' representation away so they can cut entitlements.
Yeah,
exactly
They don't like the workers having the same pay and that as high level people in this country. Yep. You know what I mean? Our wages do go up with inflation. We do get the best paydays in town.
That's right.
And our conditions are pretty good too. So
I believe some of the cops are working through people's houses going, how did you afford this? We've worked in this industry for years and years, and what's it matter? Well, we've got a decent wage so we can put a good roof over our kids' heads and stuff. And 99% of our wives work as well, all partners.
100%. The days of one parent getting one wage and making it all work are well and truly gone. So. Yeah.
That's a bit cheeky of them, though, isn't it?
They're not from this. And I don't know why it's jealousy or whatever. And look, I'm not putting all the cops in the same boat by no stretch of the imagination, but like, some of them do. a lot of them are just arrogant because they don't like us.
Yeah, and they believe in the narrative that's getting shoved down.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Making comments about what's in people's wardrobes and stuff like that there and all that there because of what type of clothes they choose to buy and stuff like that there. You know?
All fakes.
It's all, they probably don't realise it, but we're all working class together, like, you know what I mean?
That's right.
And we'll go out the same old way. Dare to struggle.
Dare to win.
And if you don't fight,
you lose.
It's good morning from the Concrete Gang.
Hey y'all, Adam Keller here from the Valley Labor Report. We're proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
All right, that brings us to Solidarity Works, a podcast from the United Steelworkers, which I guess is to differentiate it in case there are any other podcast named Solidarity Works, which, to be fair, is a fabulous name for a podcast or radio show. I'm sorry, I didn't think of it first.
Well, and not only that, Chris, but just in the network, I think we've got the Solidarity Podcast. Solidarity Center has a podcast. There's a lot of Solidarity podcasts out there.
RIP Solidarity News.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. That's right. Good call. All right, Patrick, what do we got?
Well, this one really caught my eye because I'd never even heard of the waste isolation pilot plant in New Mexico. But Chelsea Engler is talking to Dora Ledbetter and Dora Lopez, two Doras, both members of the United Steelworkers Union, who work in this facility, which is 2,000 feet underground, and it's built to safely store nuclear waste. So they're going to tell you what goes on there, what it's like working there, and how it's kind of like an underground city.
That is mind-blowing. Not only to think about the fact that we have these storage facilities, but that people are working there. I mean, it must take a special something in order to work in a place like that.
Today, we're going underground. More than 2,000 feet beneath the surface in the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, or WIP. A facility designed to safely dispose of certain radioactive waste deep underground. For the workers who keep the operation running, it's a workplace unlike almost any other. And for two USW members, it's been home for decades. Dora Ledbetter has worked at WIP since 2008, while Dora Lopez has been there since 1998. Together, they've spent nearly three decades at the site, learning the job, looking out for their coworkers, and building life in a workplace where safety is an entire culture. They've seen the facility change. They've watched equipment and infrastructure age. And they've experienced some of the challenges that come with keeping a unique operation like WIP running.
I'm Chelsea Engel, proud member of the United Steelworkers, and welcome again to Solidarity Works.
So if each of you want to go and introduce yourselves, that's just kind of how we'll start.
Okay, perfect. My name is Dora Ledbetter, and I've been here at the WIP site for about 18 years, since 2008. And what brought me out here was, of course, we all want a better opportunity and a better salary. My current role here at the Waste Isolation Pilot Plant, I work in metrology. It's instrumentation and calibration. And a typical day, it's busy, and it's kind of like a little vicious cycle. You know, our instrumentation comes in, we verify it, we send it out for calibration, and it's every month. But it's pretty busy. It's a busy little office and place here.
Hi, I'm Dora Lopez, and I've been out here since 1998, and I came out here also looking for better opportunities, pension, benefits. I work in the underground tool crib, and what I do there is I issue out tools to the different groups. Could be the like electricians, mechanics. INC also works down there, which is the related to Dora's part. And it can be slow some days, but then it all depends on the jobs that are being performed for that day, and it can get pretty busy.
Yeah. And then for folks that may not know, like, what WIP even is, how would you explain what goes on at this facility and why the work is so important?
Here at the site, what we do, of course, is we dispose of nuclear waste in the underground. And why it's so important to us is because we're the only site in the whole entire world that does it, does this, you know, receive the waste, dispose of it underground safely and compliantly. It's important because in at the generator sites, we have, you know, some of the waste that sits on surface. And, you know, it not only helps them, but it helps us because it's 2,150 feet in the underground. And I think that's very important. It's better underground than on surface.
Yes. And when you started working there, was there anything that surprised either of you about the environment, the work itself?
What really, really surprised me, I mean, I came from a mine, a potash mine. I mean, there's rules and regulations there as well, but this is a lot of procedures. I took a look at, I mean, a procedure to use a ladder. It was a procedure and lots of procedure driven to our tasks because I started as a waste handler. So that was really surprising. I'm like, oh my God, a procedure for everything. But it's good. And it's in all reality, it's safe and a lot of safety procedures as well within that.
Yeah, I imagine in a place like that, better to be safe than sorry.
Absolutely.
And then, yeah, you mentioned things like being 2,100 feet underground. I mean, even that number is kind of unimaginable to people. So for people like me who've never been in an underground repository, can you paint a picture as vividly as you can, I guess, of what it's like to go that far down in the earth, what it looks like, what it feels like?
It's dark, but we have really high backs. Some areas of the mine are dark. Some are very lit up. but it's like a little city down there because we have ambulances, we have fire protection, we have all the different groups working down there. We have safety. So
there's electricians. So it's own little city, would you say, within the underground, because pretty much what we have on surface as far as mechanical and electricians, and it's down there as well. In some of the areas, like I said, they're not as lit up as the main areas, but a little city within a city.
Yeah, that's crazy to picture.
Special thanks to Dora Ledbetter and Dora Lopez for sharing their experiences and giving us a look at what it means to spend decades doing this work.
Hey, this is Joshua Town from the Solidarity Report podcast. I'm proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts across the country and around the globe. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where the working people speak. You can find us at laborradionetwork.org.
I just love that the steelworkers, they have such interesting and varied jobs. And this, to me, is exactly what a union podcast should do, is get these kinds of stories. And I got to say, good for them, because I would not go 2,000 feet underground.
Oh, I'd take a tour.
All right.
Yeah, but you get to come back up.
That's true.
All right.
Okay.
Blue collar news. Harold, what's up?
Okay, so over in Montana, the Montana AFL-CIO's podcast, Blue Collar News, has Artie Blanco from the AFL-CIO talking about her visit to Montana and also talking about how important it is for working people to come together to elect people to represent themselves. Jason, the Secretary Treasurer at the Montana AFL-CIO, has a great conversation with her about why unions are important, but more than that, why workers have the power if they just exercise it.
Well, Labor Day is the traditional kickoff for the fall campaign season. And, you know, I know they say this every year, but the midterms are probably going to be kind of important this time around. So
yeah, thanks.
Good timing for Blue Collar News. Well done for them.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Jason Small, Executive Secretary of the Montana AFL-CIO. And today, we are bringing you another installation of the Blue Collar News. We have a special guest that traveled quite a ways, and Miss Artie Blanco. And I'd love it if you'd give us just a little introduction on yourself and what's going on.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, obviously. My name is Artie Blanco, and I am born and raised Houston, Texas. But I am a Las Vegas, Nevada girl and have lived all over the country. I am now the National Campaigns Director of the AFL-CIO and had to relocate for the fourth time to Washington, D.C. But I will be retiring in Las Vegas, hopefully in about another 7 years.
So you get to travel around the country. I mean, you're constantly talking to workers, obviously. What are you hearing from workers across the country itself as a whole?
You know, workers just want to be heard. They want to be able to have a good life. They want to be able to make enough money to not worry about basic bills like groceries, gas to get to and from work, to and from home, pick up their kids from school. They want to be able to take time off. And then somewhere in the back of their minds, now with everything else, and everything's just cost so much nowadays, They don't even have the time to think about what their potential retirement could look like. Because if we work for 20 plus years, we should be able to retire with some dignity and be able to support ourselves and have investments. So workers are really worried about it, and they're sick and tired of all the bickering about stuff that doesn't even matter to everyday life, the everyday economics.
Why do you think more workers are looking at unions as first solutions at this point in time?
Labor has a unique impact. We have a unique way of communicating. You know, I say this all the time. I think that unions were like the first progressive organization to exist. And I know progressive is not the right language. It's not probably the right word. But I would think about that gave progress to working people economically. because when you think about a contract, if a group of workers are under one contract, everybody gets the same. Everybody gets the same pay. You get the same benefits. There's a structure to get there. If there's like a layered process or whichever, depending on the industry or the sector, but that it's one contract. And that's, I think, what the premise of unions are. And you don't, it doesn't matter where your background is. It doesn't matter who you love, doesn't matter what God you pray to, or if you, even if you do. You know, it doesn't matter your skin color or your accents. None of that matters if you're all within one contract. Everybody's treated equal, everybody's treated the same, and everybody has access to the same liberties, right? And so I think that that's where I think a lot of that has come, why unions are seen at a high regard, because we're just literally there to work for working people.
So why is it important to organize and educate and bring everyone together for elections or public policy?
I love this question. You know why I love this question? I talk about this a lot in the last couple of years. Every human being has power. Everybody has power. But if we don't have the information and the knowledge, we cannot wield that power that we already have. And political power, our voice of the political power, our votes matter. Our voice of being a constituent of an elected official to hold them accountable, all that matters. And even when there's voters that say, well, my vote won't make a difference and I'm not gonna turn out, I always ask them, well, what if the other 20,000 people that felt that way actually turned out and voted? That can make that difference. That will make that difference. You have power, we all have power. We just need to make sure people have the information and the knowledge to be able to wield it for whatever reason. I hope they would do it for the good.
Right. So, you know, one of our big pushes with the Montana AFL is union member participation, but not just participation at events or, you know, getting out the vote, stuff like that. I was a sitting senator for years, union member, worked out pretty good. It's a heck of an opportunity to get to educate people to what it's actually about. So we push extremely hard in our recruitment efforts to bring in union members to run for the legislature and really proactively get involved. Across the country, does there seem to be a little bit of a move towards that in other places?
Yes, I think there has been. I think that there's been a movement for more of a citizen type elected officials that are everyday people. I think that there are folks that want to engage. There's been lots of union members that have served in public office like you have, and leaders that have served in public office. I think it's great to see that they can go beyond the workplace. And what they bring with them is the values of working people that sometimes some elected officials forget. Let's be clear. And that's on both sides, right? I don't know if I would say it's a movement. I think it's more of working people are finally fed up. They're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and they want to make change, and they're realizing, why not me? Why not now? And I think that it's amazing that union members want to step into that space.
So I want to ask you just one more question, and that is basically, when you leave Montana, what do you hope to take back with you?
Everywhere I go, I always want to be re-inspired. Every trip I take, every worker I meet that shares with me a little bit more about why they're a union member and that they know why, then no one needs to tell them why. I love that inspiration, that take that back with me. Maybe I learn a couple words. Maybe I'll learn a couple of different ways to talk about an issue. I'm always looking for that. So I hope to take that and inspiration back with me.
Right on. Well, I tell you what, I hate to burn up any more of your time. I know we got another event or two here and a lot of things going on. So I'm just going to say we appreciate it. Thank you for showing up today and hope the rest of your trip is absolutely wonderful. And
I'm sure it will be.
And you find a little inspiration in there somewhere. So we'll catch you later.
You know I will.
Hey, this is Judy Ansel from the Heartland Labor Forum. We're radio that talks back to the boss. And we're proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network, with more than 200 labor radio shows and podcasts from across the country and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
I feel like we've had something from Labor Exchange recently, but they're such a good show, I'm not surprised they're back.
Yeah, this Labor Day weekend, Robert decided to look back on Colorado labor history. You know, Robert works for the AFL-CIO out in Colorado, and like a lot of labor federations, they're having a Labor Day event. But the place they're having a Labor Day event has a really deep labor history. So Robert talks to a couple of authors who've written about some of that history and gets into things like the Columbine Massacre, the IWW, and even a guy you might have heard of, Big Bill Haywood.
And just another pitch for folks to check out the full show, because we had to cut the tributes to the recently departed labor union members Dolly Parton, Tim Curry, and Peter Cullen. So you'll want to check that out.
Autobots, roll out.
This is the Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. I'm your host, Robert Lindgren, with the Colorado AFL-CIO and Denver Newspaper Guild. On today's episode, we explore some local labor history ahead of the Labor Day holiday next week. The 90th annual Labor Day Parade in Louisville is a testament to the area's long history of coal mining, including a historic and successful strike in 1927 that ultimately led to the Columbine Mine Massacre, where company goons and the state militia opened fire on striking mine workers. I thought it would be helpful to go a little deeper into the local labor history, so we're going to listen back to some of our previous interviews. We're going to listen to Lee Campbell Hale, the author of Remembering Ludlow But Forgetting the Columbine, who gives us a little background on the 1927 strike.
Well, I'll just sort of briefly talk about the Columbine Massacre. This strike broke out in October, and it escalated, obviously, and people, strikers, were coalescing on the very few mines that were staying open. And one of those was the Columbine, which was in this company town of Serene. And so locals would go there in groups of anywhere from a couple of hundred to one was estimated up to 1,000 to march on this company town before the miners would go to work, essentially trying to get them to not go to work. The Columbine Massacre that happened on November 21st, 1927, where 20 strike police opened fire on strikers, killed six, and maybe wounded as many as 60 people. Another thing that brought me into the interest of this strike was that it was led by the Industrial Workers of the World, which almost all textbooks said that the IWW or the Wobblies were dead by the end of World War One. And so my question was, well, gee whiz, if they were dead, how did they lead what most historians would agree is the most successful strike in Colorado history? And it's called the most successful because all the coal miners in the state walked out. And because when the strike was over, they actually won most of their demands.
Well, another thing you get into in the book was the lost history for some of the Hispanic miners. Can you talk a little bit about the connection to the Hispanic community in Lafayette and the surrounding areas?
You know, sort of infamously, the Ludlow massacre was at least credited as being part of a Greek Easter celebration, so those crazy Greeks that got it going. And then, you read quotes from officials at the time, and it was all those crazy Baltic fighters, and this and that and the other. So you had all these various ethnicities who came in and who went on strike between 1910 and 1914. Well, by 1914, most of that stops because World War One starts. And a lot of immigration is curtailed. Employers still want cheap labor. So all kinds of employers looked for their cheap labor from Mexico, including Great Western Sugar, which had been using these so-called German Russians and other ethnic groups to mine their sugar beets. And so when the Wobblies came in, one of their key demands had been that Mexican workers would get paid the same as everybody else, which they were paid the Mexican wage, which was half. So in the northern fields, most of the coal was mined during cold weather, whenever that was, from around October to March. Most of the beets were worked in warm weather, which was coincidentally, the other half of the year. I've talked to people who've told me that the owners, the coal mine owners and the beet workers owners were hopeful that they could get Mexican workers to do both halves of that equation at subpar wages.
We're going to listen to Professor Ahmed White. His book, Under the Iron Heel, talks about the early history of the IWW and mentions the 1927 strike.
In fact, in 1927, as I tell in the book, the union kind of took control of a very, very significant strike right here in Colorado, a coal strike up and down the Front Range that tragically resulted in the deaths of about eight people, all of them union people during that period. The union also organized a little bit later the workers building the what was then called the Boulder Dam in Nevada. But for all intents and purposes, for most intents and purposes, by 1925, the union was, it was busted.
Yeah, and you conclude the book with that story around the 27 strike. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And then maybe talk a little bit about the Colorado connection to the Wobblies, Big Bill Haywood, and the Western Federation of Miners?
Yes, the 1927 strike was an interesting and, again, a very tragic episode in Colorado. The union was battered and busted, as I mentioned earlier, but there were still some stalwarts. And one of them was a very interesting guy called A.S. Embry. By the early 20s, he was about the most prominent IWW who wasn't in prison. He and some other Wobblies managed to both organize and kind of take hold of this strike here in Colorado, which was, again, was a coal strike. Over the usual issues of a combination of an organizing strike and a strike over wages and working conditions, which, needless to say, in coal mining back then were pretty terrible, and it was met with vicious repression, including a shooting in November of 1927 at what was ironically called the Columbine mine in a hamlet called Cernay, near Erie, here in Boulder County, where the state police, during a picket line fracas, opened fire on the workers and killed, I think, six of them. And then a couple months later, there was another fracas down in Walsenburg, where the police killed two people. That strike was broken, and it was broken by the usual combination of repression and the inherent economic strength of these employers. The most salient connection between the IWW of the 19 teens and 20s in Colorado is the Western Federation of Miners and Big Bill Haywood. And the Western Federation had been very active in so-called hard rock mining in places like Colorado and throughout the Mountain West, really. And through that process, through those struggles, the union developed a strongly militant sensibility and to some extent an element of radicalism about it. At the same time, Big Bill Haywood emerged as a prominent leader of that organization and was in that capacity when he called to order the convention the summer of 1905, at which the IWW was founded. In fact, he and others with the Western Federation of Miners brought into the early IWW the considerable membership of the Western Federation of Miners. They didn't stay. The Western Federation of Miners ended up in a rift with the IWW that eventually became quite bitter. But it was, at the founding of the IWW, the largest affiliate of that organization. And Big Bill stayed in the IWW and ended up at odds with his former fellow unionist or comrades.
This has been the Labor Exchange on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins. Make sure to join us on Labor Day in Louisville for the 90th annual parade. The Labor Exchange is a member of the Labor Radio Network. Find more great Labor Radio on laborradionetwork.org. This has been the Labor Exchange.
Hey, this is Simon Sapper from the Union Jews podcast. We're proud to be part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network with more than 200 Labor Radio shows and podcasts from across the USA and around the world. The Labor Radio Podcast Network, where working people speak. Find us at laborradionetwork.org.
All right. Time now for...
Shows You Should Know. For our PFW listeners, there's no way for us to squeeze in all the great episodes that have come across our desk over the past week. But here's a few more that you might want to check out. Like Working People, where Max talks with four members of the Empty Pockets about the work that goes into being a professional musician and the realities of trying to make a living in today's music industry.
On the Solidarity Report, Joshua and Matthew sit down with Adrian, Sierra, and another Matthew from the newly certified University of Chicago Press Workers Guild. They talk about how and why their co-workers decided to unionize.
See, there's another Solidarity podcast.
And on the Garage Mind, Tony talks with Chris Richter and Tony Seminari of Teamsters Local 179 about why IKEA's quote-unquote union-friendly branding doesn't quite match the reality on the shop floor and why their strike matters.
Going back into history, the Mine Wars Forum talks with People's archaeologist Kenny King about the objects he's unearthed at the site of the Battle of Blair Mountain, the fight to save the sacred ground, and why protecting labor history matters.
Then on Voice of the People, Mark, Jim, and Lucas explore the many purposes unions serve. They also hear from Anna Stites and Keith Souter about organizing the independent DFTBA Workers Union. Preview an upcoming Solidarity School in Missoula, and more.
That's right, folks. And those are this week's...
You're going to make me do it again, really?
I am.
Shows You Should Know.
I just wanted to hear it. You'll find all of them and hundreds more on the Labor Radio Podcast Network, laborradionetwork.org. That, folks, is a wrap for this week's Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, your roundup from more than 200 shows in the Labor Radio Podcast Network.
Find links to every show at laborradionetwork.org. And follow hashtag LaborRadioPod on all the socials, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram. Yeah, and even the other one, X, Twitter, you know the one I'm talking about. But hey, tell us what you think. info@laborradionetwork.org.
You can support the network with union-made t-shirts. You can have them in any color as long as it's black or gray. All sizes at laborradionetwork.org.
And you know, folks, Labor Day is a day to support unions, and that's why we are proud to say this podcast is recorded under a SAG-AFTRA collective bargaining agreement.
And produced by me, Chris Garlock, along with Patrick Dixon and Harold Phillips. Stay active.
Stay tuned to your local labor radio or podcast show.
And we'll see you next week. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.
Everybody be safe on the roads out there.
Support for WPFW comes in part from the WPFW Local Station Board, which is hosting the station's annual 5K Run Walk for Total Fitness on September 12th, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Bladensburg Road, Bladensburg, Maryland. This event includes a 5K trail, classes such as yoga, meditation, and double dutch, as well as other activities for children and adults. Details and how to attend are at WPFWFM.org or 202-888-5484. WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
Support for WPFW comes in part from Washington Parks and People, a nonprofit community organization, and Edwin Ortiz and La Mafia del Guanguanco, Brandon Woody, and Mumu Fresh, who will be performing at the 2026 WPFW Jazz and Justice Festival on Sunday, September 27th at Meridian Malcolm X Park to celebrate the park's 90th anniversary and WPFW's commitment to music, justice, and community. More information.